There was actually a change in the order of service. The book we are reading is Old Turtle, not Baby X. Once, long, long ago, yet somehow not so very long, when all the animals
and rocks
and winds and waters
and trees
and birds
and fish
and all the beings of the world could speak
and understand one another,
there began an argument.
It began softly at first,
quiet as the first breeze that whispered, "He is a wind who is never still."
Quiet as the stone that answered, "He is a great rock that never moves."
Gentle as the mountain that rumbled, "God is a snowy peak high above the clouds."
And the fish in the ocean that answered, "God is a swimmer in the dark blue depths of the sea."
"No," said the star, "God is a twinkling and a shining far, far away."
"No," replied the ant, "God is a sound and a smell and a feeling who is very, very close."
"God," insisted the antelope, "is a runner, swift and free, who loves to leap and race with the wind."
"She is a great tree," murmured the willow, "a part of the world, always growing and always giving."
"You are wrong," argued the island. "God is separate and apart."
"God is like the shining sun, far above all things," added the blue sky.
"No, he is a river, who flows through the very heart of things," thundered the waterfall.
"She is a hunter," roared the lion.
"God is gentle," chirped the robin.
"He is powerful," growled the bear.
And the argument grew louder and louder and louder until...
"Stop!"
a new voice spoke.
It rumbled loudly like thunder, and it whispered softly like butterfly sneezes.
The voice seemed to come from... why, it seemed to come from... Old Turtle.
Old Turtle hardly ever said anything, and certainly never argued about God.
But now Old Turtle began to speak.
"God is indeed deep," she said to the fish in the sea, "and much higher than high," she told the mountains.
"He is swift and free as the wind, and still and solid as a great rock," she said to the breezes and stones.
"She is the life of the world," Turtle said to the willow, "always close by, yet beyond the farthest twinkling light," she told the ants and the star.
"God is gentle and powerful, above all things and within all things."
"God is all that we dream of and all that we seek," said Old Turtle, "and all that we come from and all that we can find."
"God is."
Old Turtle had never said so much before. All the beings of the world were surprised, but Old Turtle had one more thing to say. "There will soon be a new family of beings in the world," she said, "and they will be strange and wonderful.
They will be reminders of all that God is.
They will come in many colors and shapes, with different faces and different ways of speaking.
Their thoughts will soar to the stars, but their feet will walk the earth.
They will possess many powers. They will be strong yet tender, a message of love from God to the earth, and a prayer from the earth back to God."
And the people came. But the people forgot. They forgot that they were a message of love and a prayer from the earth. And it began to argue about who knew God and who did not, and where God was and was not, and whether God was or was not.
And often the people misused their powers and hurt one another or killed one another.
And they hurt the earth.
Until finally even the forests began to die.
And the rivers and the oceans and the plants and the animals and the earth itself.
Because the people could not remember who they were or where God was.
Until one day there came a voice, like the growling of thunder, but as soft as butterfly sneezes.
"Please stop."
The voice seemed to come from the mountain who rumbled, "Sometimes I see God swimming in the dark blue depths of the sea."
And from the ocean who sighed, "He is often among the snow-capped peaks reflecting the sun."
From the stone who said, "I sometimes feel her breath as she blows by."
And from the breeze who whispered, "I feel his presence as I dance among the rocks."
And the star declared, "God is very close." And the island added, "His love touches everything."
And after a long, lonesome, and scary time,
the people listened and began to hear
and see God in one another
and in the beauty of all the earth.
And Old Turtle smiled.
And so did God.
We can never make the world safe by fighting. Every nation must learn that the people of all nations are children of God and must share the wealth of the world. You may say this is impractical and far away and can never be accomplished, but it is the work we are appointed to do. Sometime, somehow, somewhere, we must ever teach this great lesson.
Now, in the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us take time to honor some of life's quieter moments. You may use these moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Please join with me in an attitude of prayer. Let us give thanks for the gifts and promises of life. Let us offer the lessons we have learned as nourishment for those who will succeed us, even as we know they will create a world in which we might not be completely at home. For as time passes, some of the things it passes are old styles of comfort. And let us hear and honor the wisdom our elders have to offer us, for they have been through most of the problems that trouble us, and some of them have found wisdom that we sorely need. Let us have the faith to believe that as life is a gift, so are people gifts, and that the gifts are profoundly good. And knowing that, let us trust in tomorrow's leaders and tomorrow's possibilities more than we cling to yesterday's certainties. Yet we must not believe that all of the past must pass or that all change is good. Rather, let us learn to hold to what is truly good, to honor what is compassionate, to obey what commands us to use our gifts for the common good rather than merely our own pleasure. For we are all in this together, and the whole human sound goes up only from the full choir. Let us conspire together to make that choir bigger and to help create a world in which the whole human sound from the full choir becomes the sweetest of sounds, the music of the spheres, and the theme of a bold and compassionate humanity. Let us pray for these things. Let us pray, but not only pray. Amen.
A recent search for tolerance found an organization called Fight Hate and Promote Tolerance. This project has numerous resources for someone trying to find out about tolerance. It contains countless examples of it in the news. Gay marriage in Massachusetts, the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, etc. And our society has taken large steps towards being a tolerant society in recent years. I recall watching Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago with my parents. For those of you who don't remember, it is the story of a young lawyer, Andrew Beckett, who is fired when it becomes apparent that he has become infected with HIV and AIDS, and therefore, according to the stereotype of the time, is gay. The amazing thing about the movie was the huge amount of change that has occurred with the way most people in society view AIDS and homosexuals. Instead of, as in the movie, it being difficult to find a lawyer willing to represent Andrew Beckett due to his homosexuality, the opposite is now true. My parents and I were amazed when we realized that this movie was made in 1993, a scant 11 years ago. This increase in tolerance has shown up in a myriad of areas, too numerous to mention, from the societal classics of race and religion to the more mundane aspect of people merely tolerating different people in their own individual lives. This increase in tolerance has definitely been a good thing. Tolerance is important in two different ways. First, the tolerated gain simply by being tolerated. By being tolerated, they can be accepted into a community and society. This acceptance is key to many people's happiness and self-fulfillment. The second benefit of tolerance is to the tolerating society as a whole. The tolerance increases the diversity of the society, which countless studies and authorities claims increases the overall quality and goodness of the society. But does this tolerance that we have in today's society truly extend to everyone? The previously mentioned organization reported on many other news stories, including one regarding an ad campaign. It was attacking a proposed reality show called Amish in the City. The news story sided with the ad campaign, but to me, this seems the opposite of their declared position for tolerance. The attacking of the proposed show is very intolerant, and yet an organization to promote tolerance supports this act. The explanation is easily understandable. The show is accused of mocking the Amish, which is a completely intolerant act. But this action exposes a contradiction, or at least an ambiguity, in any doctrine of tolerance. There are likely to be people who do not accept tolerance in all things. How does a tolerant person deal with this? One cannot attempt to force tolerance on them, because this has the same result of trying to force democracy on a person. It simply doesn't work. There seems to be no action that can be taken by a tolerant person to end this intolerance. They must simply tolerate it. But a tolerant person can not easily in good conscience ignore them because this intolerance is so offensive. This is one of the greatest challenges of tolerance, how to tolerate the intolerable. Another huge challenge, along the same vein, is to tolerate everyone. This, I believe, is the biggest obstacle to complete tolerance. Everyone has their morals and their ethics. These are the rules that people live by that give them guidance for what they can do and what they can't do. Tolerance is easy when you're tolerating something that your morals and ethics are fine with, still easy when you find it not too offensive. But how many of us could truly tolerate the things that we find most offensive in life? How many of us could be tolerant towards murderers, towards rapists, towards child molesters? The list goes on. For that is the true test of tolerance. Think of the most disgusting, offensive act you can imagine, and see if you can tolerate a person that commits that act with no remorse. And if you can do this, is this tolerance really enough? Because tolerance only means, well, you tolerate the person, that you allow it to happen around you and in your community without taking action against us. Tolerance in no way means that you like it, that you encourage it, or you support those who you tolerate. Instead, you need only grin and bear it for tolerance. But is this really what we want for society? A bunch of people who go around merely tolerating each other? Does that really constitute a community or merely an assortment of people? Acceptance seems much more desirable, but much more difficult to achieve, because it is much harder to accept people who are very different from you. Acceptance would give us a real society, but less diversity because it is much harder to accept people. Although the amounts of both can increase over time, there seems to be a definite trade-off between the amount of community that a society can have and the amount of diversity. Which one is more important is a choice that people will have to make for themselves, but it seems as though we cannot have both.
We gather here today, in this room, in front of this chalice, as a congregation of religious liberals looking for a greater truth. And right here in front of us is one of the most powerful symbolic lessons to be found on that search, our chalice. While its origins pertaining to our faith are rather spiritually empty, it not being anything more than the winner of a glorified design contest, it still remains that the chalice is one of the most potent religious symbols for any faith. As the oldest recorded symbol for the feminine, the chalice is here to remind us of one of the most important lessons that our faith yearns to teach us, that of respecting all humanity as you respect yourself. One of our strongest principles is to respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person, regardless of race, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of economic status, and regardless of religious affiliation. We have a sacred duty to respect all life, regardless of our disagreements. The power of this symbol, the power of the chalice, the power of creation, acceptance, and nurturing serves as a reminder to us all. The symbol is here to remind us that when we grasp those ideas of tolerance, we have the age-old power of the chalice within us. We must not think of someone's past, someone's origins, someone's religious orientation. We must only think of them as people. For they were all created just like that flame, gently cradled and given the spark of life to dance with. This symbol of creation is a reminder to us all that true life comes from this cradling, from this nurturing of the flame. Whether in turn the flame is oil or candle, the person Christian or Jewish, the chalice, the mother, gives life to all unconditionally. This is our gift, and this is our calling. My favorite example of this is the biblical story of the Good Samaritan. This story goes that there was a man on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho, and on his way, he, quite unfortunately, encountered a band of robbers. These robbers stole all the man's possessions and beat him within an inch of his life. And there, the poor man lay on the road, while an entire day of commuters passed by without lending a hand. A very, very long time had passed when, all of a sudden, a kind stranger, identified by Jesus as a Samaritan, took up the man, bandaged him, bathed him, took him on his back, carried him into town, and brought him to the nearest inn. After he brought him to the inn, the Samaritan took care of him for the remainder of the day, and upon leaving in the morning, gave the innkeeper 2 silver pieces for his upkeep, promising also to pay the innkeeper anything more if the stranger needed any more help. The moral of this story seems to be a simple one, a one of helping your fellow man, but it goes much deeper than that. You see, that Samaritan wasn't just anybody. At the time, the Samaritans were waging a violent war against the Jews. Thus, the lesson herein is much more profound. Regardless of opinion, regardless of past experience, we must treat all who we encounter with the same tender care. Blood, birth, belief, none of these define any person or give any justification for harm. The beauty of this story is that it admits this folly, admits the folly of war, the stereotype that all enemies are enemies, even when they're off the battlefield. Respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every person is just that. We must truly be unconditional with our kindness. For not every Muslim is a terrorist. Not every Baptist preaches hellfire and brimstone. Not every Catholic is anachronistic. Not every Christian wishes to convert us. And not every American is a violent sadist. There. We must see beyond these labels. these labels we create and respect the person behind them. The Samaritan was at war with the Jew, and he was able to put away any anger, any prejudice, and simply help a man who was so desperately in need. The Samaritan didn't see the man as an enemy, as a threat, as something to be afraid of. He just saw a man who needed help. This is our power as religious liberals. We have the power to see the wonderful, beautiful myriad of all the spiritual pathways with an unfettered spirit, an unbound mind, and an unobstructed vision. We have no creedal right and wrong. We draw members from all spiritual pathways, from all callings, and we have a gift to see the world, the entire world, in that same light. We are the Samaritan. We are not bound by thoughts of religious predestiny, a hell or heaven, so we can see all the world and all its myriad paths as just that. We can rightly give life to anyone, anytime. This calling of ours, this calling of tolerance and acceptance, can be a difficult one, for we are constantly urged to put all people in the world into our boxes, label them, and forget that they're anything more than the neat little labels we put on them. We have our reasons, past experience, family ties, the opinions of others. All of these may clash with the world and may make it impossible to view all others on the same plane. But watching the world without these blinders on, without labels, taking it all on head first, regardless of what we expect of it, may be a tough goal to strive for, but it is one worth achieving. Watching the world like this, without pre-existing fear, hatred, or misunderstanding, is our highest good. This is the Samaritan's true lesson. When it comes down to every day, to our daily lives, the only thing that matters is seeing past what we are trained to see. And see the man, woman, person that is behind our prejudice. We cannot label people with any preconceived notions. If we do this, then we become every other passerby that left the poor Samaritan on the road just because we thought he was an enemy. Our thoughts do have that power. Every time you avoid a Christian because of fear of conversion, you are abandoning them and denying them crucial companionship. Every time a stranded truck intimidates you a little too much to stop because of a visible Confederate flag, you're denying a man the help he needs. Every time you don't attend a dinner party with a Hasidic friend for fear of unhealthy dinner conversation, you're denying a good friend a companion. We have the power to do many wonderful things with our love, if only we can learn to give it without fear, without prejudice, and without hesitation. Our greatest gift as a congregation is our love, is our commitment to respecting and understanding the views of all people. If we are willing to accept this lesson, the lesson of this age-old story, the lesson of our chalice, the lesson I'm telling you today, and embrace the power of tolerance, of acceptance, and understanding, we have the power to be a congregation of Good Samaritans. We have the power to be the warmth of the life-giving chalice. And when we live up to that potential, let the light of our acceptance shine, we relive that greatness, that warmth, and that life saved.
This is the one service of the year when we try to find forms that let us share with you some of the gifts of the people who have come to take our place in the world. Our youth, the future. They're great gifts. You've seen and will see and hear gifts of great insight, analysis, compassion, caring for the world, concern that it not be left in the form that we've managed to pass it to them, the same concerns we once felt. You'll hear and feel gifts of great musical sensitivity, of leadership, all the kinds of gifts that the world needs. It's a chance for us once a year to look at the new crop and to ask whether we think we're doing our job. For 2 years now, we've been a teaching church by having ministerial interns, Kathy Harrington last year and Hannah Wells this year, both tremendous women. And we've learned the responsibility that this church has to those who are preparing for the ministry, to try to give them whatever gifts we have to offer that they can receive. We have the same responsibility toward our children. And this is a year for all of us to take stock and to see some of the fruits of all of our gifts and labors. In a lot of ways, we have a harder time giving our youth religious education than a lot of traditional churches may. We aren't trying to teach them the one story they need to be saved, though we do try to influence the way they view themselves and the world, just as all churches do. But all that makes our job harder, not easier. If you teach youth to question, does it mean you don't think there are any real answers, only opinions? That, as Shakespeare said, nothing is either true or false, but thinking makes it so? I hope we don't believe that, because it isn't true. And then, how can we be open and tolerant without being so open that our brains fall out? How can we teach this generation that is coming of age to question everything without also trying to teach that there are some answers that must be honored? What is not negotiable? And by what authority? The question of how to teach religious education to our youth is very close to the question of what on earth we think we're doing here. We can be fairly criticized, I think, for not giving enough solid truths to go with the many doubts we encourage. And we could counter, if we felt defensive, that traditional religious instruction often spends too much time on yesterday's certainties and not enough time empowering students to ask today's questions and to move beyond yesterday's provisional answers, including yesterday's provisional religious answers. But these either-or choices, I think, reflect a deeper kind of conflict that marks the most basic difference between traditional religion or conservative religion and liberal religion. And that's the question of whether we think people, including young people, can be trusted. Think about this with me. If you cannot trust people to be good, if you don't think they basically are good, then it's logical to teach them clear, hard rules that must be followed without question to keep them on the straight and narrow. If you do trust that they are basically good, then you can try to teach them general values, instill in them the image of what a noble person is, what decent people try to honor with their lives. And you can trust that they will want to grow into that kind of decent person just as much as we once did and still do. To put it in theological terms, which is probably the form that's most familiar, the question is, are we creatures of original sin, original blessing, or a combination of both, but a combination in which the good still outweighs the bad? In one case, we'll teach our children to be fearful and obedient. In the other case, we'll empower them to be creative and responsible. Both paths have their excesses. Both paths have their gifts and their dangers. These aren't just theological issues. They come up any time we have to assess human nature and ask who we are and what must we do. In business management, there was a famous set of theories a few years back. I don't know whether they're still using these. Theories known as Theory A and Theory B. I may get the letters reversed here. It's been a while. But one of them, I think it was Theory A, said that workers are inherently lazy and dishonest, and you cannot trust them. They'll shirk every duty they have. They'll cut every corner they can. Based on this theory, many businesses installed time clocks and hierarchies of supervisors supervising supervisors, with the big brother watching workers everywhere, or paying them by piecework because, after all, workers must be forced to do a good job since they're inherently lazy and evil. This is the business version of the doctrine of original sin. It has many followers. Others who follow Theory B say, no, you have this all wrong. People want to make a contribution. They need to do a good job, to do important work of which they can be proud, just as we do. So we need to give them the training and the empowerment to do themselves proud, and to know that we depend on them. Those two theories create two very different kinds of business environments. And they do the same in a church, and they do the same in religious education. If you're afraid of life, if you think it's just a prelude to some other life somewhere else after you've died, then you may not care about this one as much as the other one. And if you can be sold a story guaranteeing that you'll get into this other place if you believe the story, and convince yourself that there could be a God simple enough to be fooled by such a scheme, you'll be apt to follow the rules rigorously, barely covering the fear that drives the whole fearful enterprise. And that path has a lot of followers too. Then you'll want kids to be obedient, adults to conform, to be like everyone else, to stay in bounds, not to raise too many critical or rude questions, not to tip the boat. But the fact is that while you're pretending that you're making them fit the eternal pattern of the universe, you'll really only be making them fit the rules of your little club. And that's not a lot to be proud of. Liberal religion, if it has the depth, the content, and the courage to do its job, is very different. It's a Theory B enterprise. We know that we're born with the capacity for both good and evil. We know that all the good and all the evil in the world comes from humans. So it matters a lot what we believe, how we educate our youth, and how we behave with one another. because we want to steer our next generation toward listening to the angels of their better nature rather than the demons and goblins of their lesser selves. We believe most people are basically good and want to do good. And since we believe that's grounded in some of the most profound truths about human nature, we want to influence the future and the present to trust, to educate, and to empower people to talk the larger truth and to walk the talk. Politically and religiously, we have seen our society's conservatives, the Theory A people, work hard to teach their vision to the country over the past 40 years or so, and we must admit they have succeeded spectacularly. We now live in a world built largely in the image of a world of power trumping truth, obedience over empowerment for the vast majority of people alive. In some disturbing ways, we now live in a world with such uncaring and selfish values that most people seem to believe that might makes right. That if we have the power, however we get it, then we have the right to enslave workers around the world if it can make a profit, not God knows for the workers, but for the owners. And so Walmart pressures desperate workers in China to work for 13 cents an hour, and the parking lots of Walmart stores are filled. That's us buying the goods. That's the world of Theory A. Might makes right. To the victor go the spoils. We like to say that we believe that higher, more compassionate, less exclusive values should rule our lives and our world if we're going to be serious about it. One thing we will have to do is persuade our own youth of that. We do that slightly after we've persuaded ourselves of it. Because our youth, if truth be known, don't listen to us as much as they watch us. They know what we believe without a word being spoken. And if we want them to take the reins of the world that we're handing to them, we must trust them. We must trust that they can be moved to live out of more compassionate and less greedy centers. We must trust that they can learn the difference between higher ideals and lower ideals, and that they'll prefer the higher ones. That they will be capable of doing all things, but will prefer to do what is best. And to do that, we have to teach them that there are always questions more profound than even our answers, vulnerabilities more powerful than strength, and that there is a kind of peace that can pass the understanding of those who believe that might makes right, and that money gives you the right to purchase not only goods, but also people, including people's hope and security and future. That's Theory A, and it's wrong. So I would want to speak both to the parents and to the youth here. To the youth, I want to say that it's terribly important that you regard the lives of others as sacred, and that you never act in ways that reduce other human beings to things, to means whose only purpose is to serve your wants. It's immoral. It's wrong. And it makes you small. Don't do it. And among the kind of people we hope you will prefer to be around, that isn't merely an opinion. And I would also say what no teenager ever wants to believe, that while getting older doesn't necessarily mean getting wiser, that they know. There are plenty of old fools, as you've all seen already. There's also a lot you need to learn from a lot of older people who've been where you are now and have found some courageous and principled paths that led them into lives worth admiring and worth emulating. I'll give you just one example, and I've purposely picked it from a very odd, unexpected place, just to give you a feeling of how widespread this kind of wisdom can be, and what different kinds of people you can learn it from. I want to borrow just a couple lessons from the West Point Honor Code, the code of honor that's binding on all cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, a school I think very few here have attended or will attend. They say that you should not lie or cheat or tolerate people who do. They're right. You should not lie or cheat or associate with people who do. They also say, and this is much harder, that whenever you're faced with a difficult choice between two paths that may both seem right, you should always choose the harder right, the one that demands more of you, the one that believes you are a person of character of whom only the best should be expected. You don't have to be in the military for these things to carry a lot of wisdom. You're in that most formative, important, and I think, looking way back on it, frustrating, maddening period of your lives, when your job is to learn how to grow beyond the roles you've played in your families and into adult roles that you have to help create. It matters a lot what you believe and how you live. The future of the world depends on it. I think most of us have tried, as well as we know, to serve you. And though I'm sure we have room for a lot of improvement, I hope and believe that we've also given you some seeds that might, with your care and nurture, blossom into fine, wise, and fulfilling lives. And to the parents and the older folks, I would say that from here on, we'll have a better chance of influencing our kids if we begin to trust that they are genuinely trying to become good people and responsible adults, no matter how they dress, and that they are hungry for respectful wisdom. We must all trust the potential of the future more than we worship the achievements of even our own past. That's the essence of religious faith. It is not the sad sigh that this too shall pass. It is the earnest belief that this too shall grow, that these young people too have the chance of hearing the angels of their better nature and growing into the kind of people we always hoped we might become. We really are all in this together. And the whole human sound goes up only from the full choir. We are good people with good heads and hearts who can be, if we choose, the hope for a better world. That's the song we hope to sing, but it cannot be performed as a solo. Let us learn how to make music together.